For this week's episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast, we have a lot of listener questions that have come in, and so I'm just going to try to tackle as many of those as I can get to in today's episode. And, you know, obviously feel free to put me on faster speak or double speak or 1.5x or whatever you do in your podcast. Some of these are going to be relevant to you, some of them won't be, but I think all of them are pretty pressing questions. So I hope you enjoy. The first question today we're going to talk about is how the double consolidation mess is affected for Parent Plus folks by this whole pause and what to do.
Good morning. I have four children, and I took Parent Plus loans out for two of my children, and my wife has taken Parent Plus loans out for my other two children, and we are both married. We file our taxes that way. I have a question regarding my wife's student loans. I already double consolidated my student loans because those two children have graduated college and are moving on to their professions. My wife's student loans that she pulled from my other two children, they are still in college and do not graduate till May of 2025. Can I start the double loan consolidation process prior to them graduating? I'd like to try to take advantage of that as well, based upon your videos that I've watched, numerous ones, that the due date is July of 2025, and I should be starting to December of 2024 to complete this task. Those two children will not be graduated till May. All of their student loans should be pulled by that time, but I'd like to understand some options for those two students that I would like to process the double loan consolidation and take advantage of that. Because currently my wife and I have a lot of money tied up in Parent Plus loans for all four of our children. And I'd like to try to do the best I can to mitigate any of those future costs wherever possible. Any feedback or phone calls or information would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and hopefully you can help me out.
So in general, when you've got these Parent Plus loans and you're trying to figure out, you know, can I start double consolidating them sooner if I've got kids still in school? The answer is yes. You can double consolidate before the last kid is done. What you generally have to do is just take advantage of the fact that Parent Plus loans, you can get them out of this deferment period, and you can go ahead and do that consolidation. But the problem is, of course, is if you have everything shut down in a system completely, then you can't take action until that stuff is fixed first. So that's kind of what we're stuck at right now. The one positive thing I'd say with this, with the injunction, is that the rule that phases out the double consolidation loophole is actually part of the SAVE plan. So if SAVE got struck down kind of randomly, the double consolidation thing might go away as well, and in terms of the limit on it, and then that might not be July 2025. So everything kind of depends on what happens with this lawsuit for that. So now another question.
Hello, Travis. My name is Mike. I just wanted to start by saying that I appreciate your podcast and everything that your company does to help out student loan borrowers with providing unbiased information. My big question is, with the election coming up, is there a chance that if President Trump is elected, that he will get rid of the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program? I know that in the past he's talked about getting rid of it when he was president previously, but my concern would be if we're already enrolled in the program trying to get that, can he axe the program to where we no longer have that possibility? I'm up to get my loans forgiven this year, so it doesn't affect me so much, but my wife isn't until next year. So we've spent then 9, almost 10 years, and then if he axes that program out, you know, we'll have more debt, and it'll just cause a lot of problems financially for our family because, you know, we were told that there was this plan, and then all of a sudden they just ripped it out from under us. I know it's hard to speculate based on an election, but I think that's a question that me and a lot of other PSLF borrowers have right now, is if President Trump is elected in this upcoming election, is the PSLF program possibly going to go away and affect people that are already paying into this program and counting on it? So I appreciate you taking my question and your time, and hope you have a good rest of the day.
I remember I had an article about Trump repealing PSLF and could he and would he and those kind of things. And that article was really popular when he unexpectedly won back in 2016, and people were really worried about it then. You want to just take a sober look at this and say, well, what does the law say? First of all, the law says you got to do PSLF. It's got to be allowed. So you can't just repeal PSLF unless you have 60 votes in the Senate, because that's what you have to have. You don't have the filibuster being overturned yet. Since the filibuster's not been overturned yet, you would need 60 votes in the Senate to repeal PSLF. So let's say you had Trump win and Republicans win both houses of Congress. Well, if that were to occur, they would still need 60 votes in the Senate to get rid of PSLF. Now, let's say that everything in the world is tossed out that's not in the law, well, in terms of IDR plans like SAVE, well, then IBR is still an option. And the big thing that I'm concerned about is the payment cap for IBR, people not being able to access IBR due to that, due to how long it's been since people have recertified their income. The good news is I don't think you have to worry about Trump repealing PSLF at all. What I would be concerned about is, will IDR plans be significantly scaled back so that it's harder to get into PSLF? And I think that we'll be able to think of some creative ways around that if that does happen. We'll probably have to think of some creative ways to get people into PSLF or into, I mean, I should say income-driven repayment, income-based repayment specifically, if SAVE gets tossed. But that's just a wait-and-see kind of thing. We'll have to wait and find out. Now, another question.
Hi, Travis. My name is Katie, and this is a financial planner question. My husband's from Montana, and I'm from Hawaii. We have two properties in Montana that we rent out, and we're living in a really small two-bedroom apartment here in Honolulu. I recently was offered an early inheritance to buy, and my father's advocating that we do it here in Hawaii. And our ultimate dream would be to have the girls rafting and backpacking in Montana in the summers and here in the rest of the year for school in Hawaii. So I would just love to get your opinion to think outside of the box. Do we buy a house, a smaller apartment for cash and lower expenses that way and stay somewhat uncomfortable? Or do we take on a mortgage and buy a home that might be a better investment and more comfortable? I'd love to maybe hire you for those services to look at our financials or just get your opinion on that. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much.
So this is a fun question because I think that this one is just kind of like, what's the most optimal way to set up my finances for this dream, right? Like I want to live in where the weather's great and the outdoors are incredibly enjoyable when the weather's nice. And then when it's not nice, you know, I want to go live in a really nice place where it's not too cold and I can enjoy that. So I think that the way I would think about this is tourist season in the hot area is probably in the summer, even though it's not as pleasant as it's during the winter, right? So I would suspect that a primary residence that is allowed to be put on Airbnb would be pretty valuable to tourists in the summer. And then my guess would be that for the winter months in a cold place like Montana, that there wouldn't be much of a market for renting out like a 9-month rental or something like that in a place like Montana. So I think the optimal thing to do would probably be, now the thing about homeownership in an expensive place like Hawaii is homeownership is kind of difficult to justify from a price to rent ratio in Hawaii, just because it's a very high priced area relative to what you can rent for. But I would just say if you have financial abundance, I would probably look at maybe buying a place, like owning a place in Hawaii, even though it's a little bit more expensive. I'd probably try to see if I could put it on Airbnb in the summer and then take the money from Airbnb and then use that to rent a place out in Montana where you probably could find a similar kind of Airbnb kind of situation in Montana for 3 months a year and possibly even negotiate a better deal off market, off of Airbnb. After maybe you've stayed there for two summers in a row, you might be able to just contact the owner directly and get a better deal because of how much the fees are, right, that the platforms take. So that's kind of a fun way to think out of the box, right? I think that I love it when people think out of the box about what's possible for their financial lives. That's a great question. If somebody had a random question like that and just wanted to see what financial planning could do for them, you could go to slpwealth.com/pod for an intro call link. So let's just keep listening. More questions.
Hey there, kind of a long time listener here. I want to thank you for your podcast. I have a couple questions about getting married and how they relate to income recertification. Some basic facts. I'm a federal employee. I'm a little less than 3 years out from forgiveness with PSLF. I have about $26,000 in student loan debt. I make, as of right now, about $56,000 before taxes. So that's kind of my situation. My fiance makes pretty much the exact same amount of money as I do. She's going to take a little bit of a pay cut soon, but not significant, because she's going to go back to school in January. And she has zero student loan debt. And we are hopefully going to be able to send her back taking out very, very little, maybe less than $5,000 in loans. But that's not really what my question is about. My question is, because I'm a federal employee, she's eventually going to have to be working part-time while she's in school. She's going to go on my health, vision, dental benefits, etc. Pretty obvious reasons. I have great coverage, super grateful. But although I'm pretty confident that for 2024, we were going to want to file separately, if my labor contract gets awesome for some reason, that may make our incomes more disparate, and then we would file jointly. And I really want to make sure when I put her on my benefits, I don't screw up that we won't be able to decide between jointly and separately, because I have a FSA, and I really could not find the answer anywhere that if we were to file separately, but she has been reimbursed for healthcare costs through my health insurance, but from my FSA, if that is fair game. I don't know if that makes sense, that she would be getting her medical costs reimbursed from my FSA, but she, for filing separately, is not like a dependent of mine, and like I'm a household of one. I couldn't really figure out a straight answer. It seemed pretty clear with dependents, like children, which we don't have any, that they would be able to access my health insurance and FSA even if they weren't claimed as a dependent on my taxes. But I could not get a really clear answer on spouse if you're filing separately. Just want to make sure I don't mess that up, and like, she's got to go on my health insurance, so if that means we have to file jointly, that's fine. It's just something to kind of plan ahead for, because it's definitely going to raise my income-based repayment, which, yeah, again, isn't until July of 25, so I've got time. But as we're sending her back to school and trying to budget for that, I do want to kind of have the planning ahead of what kind of loan payment might I need to budget for if it is going to go up because of the health insurance situation. I would love your help with that. Thanks. Again, really appreciate the podcast. It's a huge help, especially since she doesn't have any loans. So it's just me trying to figure it out for me.
One thing I would say is just don't let the tail wag the dog. First of all, you got to think, is my loan forgivable? Is it forgivable with all the context of all this mess that's going on with the lawsuits and such? Like, we might be in a situation where some people that have modest sized debts just really cannot get forgiveness because it just isn't functionally possible, right? If the save plan goes away, somebody might not be able to get their loans forgiven via PSLF potentially. So I think that would be step one, is figure out even if forgiveness is even on the table. If it's not on the table, then you know, you don't have to worry about anything. You should just file a joint and not worry about any of it, right? In terms of benefits in general, the married filing separate impact does have limits on like how much you can contribute to FSA and HSA kind of situations. A lot of times if you were, and this is just me talking based off of my conversations with the tax team, I'm going to put that disclaimer out that I'm not a tax professional, and we hire tax professionals. But my understanding is that you, if you file separate, if each of you has like your own HSA or FSA, you can like contribute up to the max for you and individually if you each have one, but you can't do the full family contribution to just one of yours. In terms of paying out benefits, I think that that's something that I would have to defer to on the tax team, to be honest. My guess would be probably you couldn't if you file separate. But I do think that a spouse could be on your health insurance if you're married filing separate. So keep in mind, like a lot of stuff with the IRS does not impact your benefits. Your benefits don't even know how you filed your taxes other than are you a spouse or not. And then think about the tax status name, married filing separate. Well, it does mean you're married, right? It says it literally in the title of the status of the tax filing. The good news is married filing separate very rarely has any negative impact on benefits, for the exception of, you know, HSAs and FSAs tend to have a little bit lower cap if you do separate. Now, another question.
Hey there, question about the SAFE plan injunction. Listen to the podcast episode. So I know that with all the changes to IDR, one thing that they introduced was if you were on an income plan going towards forgiveness and going towards PSLF, you could like pay ahead. My payment is $60. If I paid $600 at once, it would count as 10 payments, as if I, you know, it wasn't going to count as one. It would count for each month that I paid for. And so I'm curious, because you could do it for as long as until your recertification date. Mine's like July of 25. So if saves in jeopardy, but I could afford, I'm getting a little bonus to just pay my next 12 payments up front now, and then theoretically get 12 payments counted towards my PSLF with the current payment amount, because it's obviously going to go up. Like, I'm sure there'll be speculation on your end, but do you think that would be an option to avoid paying a higher payment amount monthly if I just had the money to pay off the whole year at the rate I currently have and get those 12 more months until my recertification date in July of 25? And then, you know, whatever happens, happens. If my payment's higher or lower, then that's what it's going to be. It's also just kind of maximize the low payment I have now, since I could afford to just pay a lump sum right now. I'm sure it'll be speculation, because if save goes away, that may be something they would address. I don't know. So, thanks.
So the problem with this whole injunction is like the paid ahead stuff, paying a lump sum, and I just wouldn't even fool with that right now. It's so messy. I've got just so little confidence in Department of Education at the moment that I just would not at all try to game the system or anything unless I was forced to. So what I mean by forced to is, let's say your employer says you have to use this money on your loans. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it, and it's got to go only towards loans. You know, in that kind of situation, if you have no choice at all, if you cannot defer that reward till a future year or a future period, if you are forced to do it, then I would try to time it up where it's right after your annual income certification date. So if that's, say it's July 1, I'd try to make a lump sum right after that to get up to 12 months of credit in theory. But the problem is right now they are issuing all kinds of conflicting guidance, frankly, and just it's all over the place. And I just would not trust at all making any extra payments. I think what we're going to be living with this injunction is effectively it's either going to say, hey, it's all okay, in which case they'll probably try to call this administrative forbearance and retroactively count all of it. If save is unexpectedly held up, if part of save is struck down, they might try to do the same. And then if save is completely blocked, then I think that they will try to do PSLF buyback when people hit 120 months of credit. That's going to be a mess too, but you'll have to make those payments after the point where you think you would have been at 120 payments. Then you apply for PSLF buyback and you do a lump sum. So it's just a big mess, but I would just say the general answer is you need to wait and then wait to do that lump sum PSLF buyback like later. Now, another question.
Hi, Travis. My daughter is a recent May 2024 graduate of veterinary school. She'll be starting a new job in August, making $130,000 a year. Unfortunately, she's got student loan debt of about $375,000. With all the changes currently happening in the student loan world, especially with the late changes to the SAVE program and its uncertainty, what advice do you have for new 2024 grads going forward and how they should plan for their student loan programs? Thank you.
So for new grads, I think I would just say you can't consolidate at the moment with the injunction in place and your grace period 6 months. So technically, after your 6 month grace period is up, you can apply for IDR, and I probably would. So if we still do not have an answer by, you know, a lot of people graduate in June, so 6 months after that, it's basically November. So if we still don't have an answer on this whole SAVE lawsuit by then and the online application to consolidate is still not present, then I would probably just go ahead and do a paper application for income-driven repayment. And you could at least say, hey, I applied and I applied for income-based repayment. So at least you can start getting credit on that $0 a month payment amount based off of your most recent tax return. So we have to do paper applications for Parent Plus borrowers all the time. So we do know how to do it. Basically, you have to submit an IDR application in there, and you know, generally speaking, have to also provide proof of income. And it's a big old mess, to be honest. But we're just going to have to wait and see. I think that's the short answer. I would just say the good news is if somebody just graduated, it's probable that if you just graduated from vet school, then like you probably were an undergrad from 2016 to 2020. And so if you're a new borrower as of 2014, which becomes more and more and more likely every single year, right? Because that new borrower as of 2014 means you didn't have any existing balance on that date. And if you are a new borrower, then IBR, which is in the statute of the law and can't be touched without 60 votes in the Senate, is the pay-as-you-earn plan, basically. It's 20 years until forgiveness, 10% of your income. It is guaranteed to offer forgiveness in the law, so they can't just change it or touch it like that. And it allows you to file taxes separately. So I think for me, I have comfort in just that overall picture that somebody making 130 with 375K of debt is still in great shape financially, because you can still treat that 375 as a very attractive income tax instead of a, and I say attractive because it provided the means to earn 130K instead of coming out of undergrad and earning 70. So, you know, you take 10% of your IDR payment off the top of that 130, that's about 117 or so, right? Left over. 117 is the income as if you were making $0, as if you had $0 of student loan debt. So I think that there's still a lot of hope here. There's still a lot of glass half full situations, even in this really confusing and difficult season. Now, another question.
Hi, my name is Annie. I'm in Ohio. I'm pursuing PSLF and I'm on the SAVE plan. I just want to confirm that based on our current understanding, administrative forbearance on our accounts means these months do count towards PSLF. You've probably said it before. I think we would all be happy to hear it again confirmed. Thanks.
I wanted to feature this one simply because I wanted you guys to hear it from me. It does not count. It does not count. And I know that's difficult to hear. I think I've hopefully said that many times on the podcast here, but I wanted to just make sure that we have no misconception here that this whole SAVE plan forbearance does not count towards PSLF. And the reason is because Department of Ed has vibes. I mean, seriously, Department of Ed is making it up as they go along. They are not really following things very carefully. I mean, it's like technically the injunction stopped the whole SAVE plan rule where the administrative forbearance counts towards IDR. And then now it doesn't because they put the kibosh on the whole rule. But the thing is, what's kind of crazy is like some of the administrative forbearance stuff counting for PSLF is like in a different rule. So it's like, why doesn't this count? I don't have a great answer for you. I think that it's because they're essentially saying the SAVE plan is completely legal in the injunction, and therefore you can't, it's not even a qualifying kind of period of forbearance because it's not a qualifying plan in the first place. I'm not real clear why Department of Education decided to not count this period for PSLF, but they are not counting it unless there's an unexpected victory in the courts, and then they would probably retroactively try to count it. So that's what we're dealing with right now, and I hope they do retroactively change it, but they're saying very clearly it does not count. So let's do another question.
I had a question regarding people who were prematurely asked to recertify their income. So for background, I had my loans with Mohila, and I had a $0 per month payment because it's based on my income from back in like 2019. And my income recertification date is in March every year. And back in February, Mohila asked me to submit documentation to recalculate my payment, after which my payment went from $0 per month to $600 per month. And shortly after that, the Biden administration had pushed back the income recertification dates to no earlier than November of 2024. At the time, my payment still showed as being $600 per month with Mohila, despite guidance from the federal government showing or saying that if borrowers were asked to prematurely recalculate their payment and their payment went up, it would go back to, you know, whichever payment was lower, the old payment or the new recalculated one. So my understanding is that my payment should go back down to $0 per month. I called Mohila about that, and they said basically to just sit and wait, and eventually it would go into their system and be reverted back to $0. But then my loans were subsequently transferred to Ed Financial, where it still shows I have a payment of $600 per month. I've called them multiple times about this, tried to explain it. They're saying their hands are tied because there's been some sort of freeze or injunction on all of the IDR accounts, and they're not able to make any adjustments to monthly payments or recalculate any payments. So as it stands, I now have a $600 per month payment that I don't really want to make, because previously I was making $0 payments that were counting towards forgiveness, seemingly helpless staff at Ed Financial. So I was just wondering, I mean, surely I cannot be the only borrower in this situation. Have you guys encountered anything like this? What are you guys recommending that people do? Because as it stands now, I'm sort of choosing between either paying the $600 a month payment that I really shouldn't be paying on guidance of the federal government, and just hope that one day it will be reimbursed, or continue to make my own $0 a month payments and just wait for the federal government to issue more further guidance, and then hope that these missed payments that I'm making eventually become recognized as $0 payments that will contribute to my forgiveness counts for PSLF. I'm looking forward to your input on this. Thanks.
No, you are not the only person dealing with this recertification problem. So I want to give you guys a peek behind the curtain here as to how the income recertification process works. You might have heard that they're allowed, you know, to just pull your information directly from the IRS info. But that's part of, I think that's part of the whole rule that's currently been dealt the injunction. And so what happens with this stuff is 90 days before they tell you, hey, it's time to submit your information to recertify your IDR payment. So that's 90 days before is when they tell you, hey, it's about time to recertify your income. And then 35 days before, roughly, they say it's due. And they send you the information, they send you an email, hey, you know, you've got to recertify, it's time. And then 10 days before your recertification date, if you haven't turned it in by that point, you potentially get kicked out of the plan. You can't stay on you don't really get kicked out of the plan. Your payment just goes up to the cap, basically, if you haven't submitted that information. If you're on like a capped plan, if you're on an uncapped plan, they might switch you out of the, you know, if you were on Save or Repay, they might switch you into some sort of alternative standard type of plan or something like that. So basically, the gist is, if you're unsure about recertifying, I would kind of wait until maybe, you know, maybe a safe number might be like half a month before, 2 weeks before the actual due date. Because then you're not late, but you're still waiting up until the very last second. Now, I mean, to be honest, right now, it doesn't even matter because, you know, everything got recertified, but everything got frozen, right? And so everybody's dealing with this save forbearance if you're on that. Now, if you are on a different plan, right, if you were on the pay plan or something like that, or IBR, then it would matter more about getting that payment recalculated, because that is the guidance from the Department of Ed, that it's supposed to not happen certification before November 2024. It's supposed to get kicked out if you recertified earlier than that, or if your date was before that. And ultimately, it might require filing an FSA complaint. So if you just Google search FSA complaint, that is the quickest way to submit a complaint about something that's wrong with your servicer. And that's probably the most effective way if you want to submit something quickly and efficiently. And then you can escalate from there to like an ombudsman. You can do a CFPB complaint if you wanted to. But you know, also you could get your constituent services office involved for your congressperson or senator. And that's also effective if all your other options just don't work. So remember FSA complaint. It might come in useful if you Google search that to submit a complaint next time instead of just wasting hours on the phone with these servicer reps that often have no idea what to do. And just to avoid recertifying early, and the next time you do it, you know, I would just know that rule about the like 90-35-10 rule, where it's like actually late at 10 days before your certification date. You can turn it in 2 or 3 weeks before it's due without consequence. Now for another question.
Hi, my name is Krista Ben David. I worked with Dan last year for the PSLF and working towards my forgiveness. My 120th payment is actually this month, or should be this month, but with everything that's going on, I'm just not sure that I'm eligible to submit or how that would work for me. I've been in forbearance through Mohela since they've transitioned off of the platform, I think since May, and I haven't made a payment since then. And I don't fully understand the RetroPay buyback that you're talking about in your podcast, so I wanted to come here and send a message to see if you have any more information on that. I have been submitting my verification through the hospital pretty much every few months so that I am up to date, and my account before it went out of the transition was up to date since I think about January or February. So I had only about 6 payments left, which would have equated to August being the last payment. Just curious on what your thoughts are and what I should do. Thanks.
So for this one, I think that you need to go ahead and try to do the PSLF buyback. I think you need to wait until you're at your 120th month of credit. And then I think that you need to go ahead and apply with the PSLF application and say, I believe I qualify. And then I think that I would go ahead and try to be one of the very first people to test the PSLF buyback and say, hey, figure out what I should have paid during these months that I was in forbearance. And then I want to be able to pay that as a lump sum and be done. And then, you know, if you need to escalate things through an FSA complaint or getting constituent services involved or even us involved, email us after you've gone ahead and, you know, applied for PS Love Buyback by submitting your actual formal application. So I think you need to go ahead and apply first. And then I think that you need to potentially, if they have problems, I think you need to do a an FSA complaint. And you know, that'd be wonderful if you were successful with PS Love Buyback. I think we need to have you on the podcast, because I think a lot of other people want to see how successful you've been with it as well. So good luck. And I hope you go ahead and submit once you think you qualify, which should be very, very soon. Now let's do another question.
Hello. Yes, thank you. I appreciate your videos on Instagram. I've been watching 2 or 3 months. I was wondering what's going on with specifically with 8Advantage. They've been saying that we're on forbearance and 0% interest, but then our balance keeps going up. When I initially started asking some of the reps there, they said, well, they're not sure what's going on with the safe plan. And then now the vernacular is turned into, well, since the safe plan is on pause and there's forbearance, once it goes back into repayment, they're going to remove the interest. I don't really have that in writing other than one of the representatives put that in chat and I printed out the chat. So just to have something. The other piece of it, I made an extra payment and it was under the lower safe plan amount. And instead of it going to principal, it went to the interest since interest was accruing. So then I had to call them and tell them to move that payment from being applied to interest to being applied to principal. So it makes it really complicated to see, you know, how to navigate that, since it seems like the representatives for 8Advantage really, they're kind of all over the place. They're just now starting to have the same answer. And on top of that, it seems like if I do want to make extra payments and make it towards principal, it's kind of a pain. I've got to call back after it processes and make sure that it's applied to principal and so on and so forth. So just wanted to kind of hear your thoughts. Just was curious what you've seen with that. Thank you much.
Basically, what I would tell you is every time servicers often make mistakes and they often don't do something and don't apply something Department of Education's promised until weeks or even a couple months after they've promised it, because Department of Education, again, just governs based on vibes instead of based off of actually a lot of things that are written down very clearly. And so I think that's why some of this interest is accruing, is because Department of Ed hasn't really helped servicers implement a lot of the things that they have promised already. And so I do think that that stuff will be reversed. One point about payments being made to the interest instead of the principal, payments are always supposed to be applied first to any existing accrued interest that's already on the account. So usually, you know, what happens is you have like principal and you have your accrued interest, and that's historical stuff that's just accumulated. So technically, payments always go towards accrued interest first, and then they go to principal. It's money you still owe on that accrued interest, so it still is fine to have the payment go towards that accrued interest. You're actually not even really supposed to have an option, but it's just something to know that it's a lot of times, you know, that accrued interest is not current interest that's being charged. It's interest that has already existed from like when you were an in-school deferment, for example. So just a fun fact. Let's do another question.
Hi. I have student loans that are Parent Plus and some graduate loans. I do work for a government, so I should get loan forgiveness. I thought the deadline was September, but was incorrect. It was in June, so you could get credit for past payments you've made. I didn't know what the best scenario is for me moving forward. Do I need to consolidate, move everything to a direct loan, change whatever, how the payment is? I'm not sure how much that goes up a month, but it's a sizable amount that I do owe. Love to hear from you, whatever suggestions, or if I need to subscribe to get the student loan planner itself. So hopefully I can figure out a plan to get me out of debt in less than 10 years to get some credit for my past ones. Thank you.
So for this question, I mean, again, I would just say, if you've missed the IDR account adjustment, it's not the end of the world. I think that your existing loans might already have some credit, like some of them might, right? If you have any loans at all that, you know, your IDR account adjustment possibly is sort of like somewhat applied like to existing loans. Now for the PS Left adjustment, you know, with forbearance and such, I mean, it kind of depends, I think. So, I mean, I think what I would do is just, first of all, can't do anything right now because everything's on freeze anyway. I would first go ahead and apply for PS Left and just go ahead and send all that stuff in. At least get yourself on to being tracked. And if you've got 10 years, I'm assuming this person's up PS Left eligible for their Parent Plus and their grad loans themselves. So I think that what I would try to do is just try to, first of all, get a plan overall, figure out, you know, what would your payments be on ICR? What would your payments be on IBR? And then what would your payments be on save if by some miracle it survives? And then see if you could get forgiveness, see if there's creative things you can do to get low payments enough to get forgiveness under any of those plans. Sometimes you can get forgiveness under all three of those plans because your debt to income ratio just makes sense. And then it's just, you're going for forgiveness no matter what. It's just the question is, how much will you pay? So I think you just got to figure out, can you get forgiveness under all the plans or just some of them? And then you would want to think about, when they unblock consolidation, could you potentially consolidate and get some credit from like a weighted average kind of thing? Because that's what the new rules are supposed to be, is they give you weighted average credit instead of giving you credit based on the loan that's the oldest. So hopefully that helps. And let's do another question.
So my question is the PSLF and IDR waiver and consolidation waiver, are those protected under any sort of law? My main concern is I consolidated to hopefully take advantage of payment count recalculation. And my concern is at some point they're going to be like, well, you consolidated and that resets your counter. So I've been looking for clarification on that. Obviously, my hope is that they stay true to their word and just update my payment count. But I'm just curious about that, if that's protected by any sort of law or statute.
So the honest answer about this one is no. There is no law that protects the IDR waiver or the PSLF waiver. But we have to think bigger when it comes to these things. Specifically, stuff sticks to the degree that it's impossible for anybody at a Department of Education or otherwise to unwind it. So in terms of the IDR account adjustment and the PSLF waiver, right? If they were to say, hey, this was not allowed, that would require them to reinstate all the loans that have already been forgiven. If we're talking about something being overturned, like the IDR waiver or the PSLF waiver, first of all, you would need a lawsuit that challenges it. There is no lawsuit that is challenging that at all. The IDR waiver and the PSLF waiver are already over, so those things have already finished. That is very different from what happened with the SAVE plan, where, you know, actively the law was about to go into place or the rule was about to go into place in full, and they sued to block it. If you really think about what it would mean for the IDR waiver and the PSLF waiver to somehow be undone by some court or some sort of administration or something, you would have to go back and reset everyone's payment count to zero. That is something that probably does not get you a bunch of savings in terms of like the CBO score. So that's not like a revenue raiser, really, in the same way that, you know, raising taxes would be a revenue raiser, or reducing spending would be an expense reducer. There wouldn't be really much of a political reward for something like that, whereas something like the SAVE plan has a very tangible CBO cost that is yet to be realized, which is the $400 billion cost. Why am I concerned by the SAVE plan, to a lesser degree, pay and repay? Those are the things we have to pay attention to, because somebody challenged those before the period that, you know, you can't really challenge it anymore. If they had waited until SAVE was fully in force, they really would not have been able to challenge it. So that's kind of why that happened the way it did. Now, some people might hear my answer and say, oh my gosh, should I be worried? The answer is no, I don't think you should. I really just think that it is just a function of, you just have to go based off of what would be possible for them to undo and what would not be possible for them to undo. So let's do another question.
Hey, Travis, this is Aaron from Michigan. I have a question about the buyback program for PSLF being on the SAVE plan. I'm on track to hit the 120th payment this month in August 2024, but like everybody else on the SAVE plan, I am now in forbearance, so I can't make that payment currently. My plan is to do a buyback so I get credit for it, and I know I need to wait until after this month in order to do it. The question I have is about the timing, because I also know I need to have my employment certified. So should I submit the employment certification form first and wait for that to go through before submitting the buyback request? Or should I submit them at the same time? Or should I do the buyback request first and then submit the employment certification form once I get the paperwork for that? I've heard different things calling into the student aid MOHELA people, so I just would love your advice. Thanks so much.
So for this one, I would be aggressive. I would go ahead and submit, because you say you believe that you qualify. I mean, that's kind of the way you do with a PSLF application anyway. If you haven't submitted your ECF form, but you're already at the 120 months, you submit basically the same PSLF application basically that you use to certify your employment along the way. You just check a different box. So it just says, I believe I qualify, versus I'm looking to recertify my employment. So I would just go ahead and submit that. And then if you get rejected, then you just have to probably appeal and do this buyback stuff. Because let's be frank, nobody's done the buyback before, really. This is the first time anybody's even thinking about buyback because of this administrative forbearance from the SAVE plan. So you'll have to be a pioneer here and just give it a try and let us know how it goes. Another question.
I had applied and completed my double consolidation of my Parent PLUS loans, with the final servicer being Mohila, as I work for a nonprofit and I want to pursue PSLF. It is completed on the Mohila site and payments began May 1st. I had submitted a paper application for SAVE as my income-driven plan in order to qualify for PSLF at the end of May. As nothing was showing on the Mohila site after a month, I uploaded the application directly on their site on July 2nd. When I called mid-July, I was told that they have both applications for SAVE and it would be up to 90 business days to process the application. This was before the legal stays. The FSA site still has the final consolidation listed as under review with a date in April of earlier this year. With my paper SAVE still floating somewhere at Mohila, is it worth sending in a second application for IBR? It doesn't seem like pay is being offered, but that might be also due to current stays.
I would not, in this case, submit a second application. I would just say that there's nothing else we can do but wait. I mean, ultimately, for Parent PLUS borrowers, right, that were hoping for the SAVE plan that might not get it, what do you do? Well, repay is could be an option. Pay could be an option when the debt settles. And worst case scenario, IBR should be an option. And IBR is a lot more generous than the ICR plan because it's 15% of income with 150% of the poverty line as a deduction. And that's if you're not a new borrower. If you're a new borrower, then it's even better. Now, for Parent PLUS borrowers, a lot of those folks would not qualify for the new IBR status because of being a new borrower as of 2014. But I did have a Parent PLUS borrower recently who was a new borrower because she had her own loans from like the 80s and 90s. And then she took out loans for her kids, you know, 2016 to now. And so she was a new borrower because her old loans were already paid off when she borrowed her first loan after 2014. So a lot of loopholes, but I know it's frustrating. Let's do another question.
Hi, this is Justin. The one aspect that I don't ever see reflected in any of the calculators or on your blog is how to think about when you have a gap between your undergrad and grad. I wasn't quite sure if your loans aren't consolidated, if they get forgiven at different timelines, and then how that would potentially affect your payments. I just never see this piece actually addressed, and I feel like it's a relatively common situation.
So for this one, I think that, you know, you just wanted to think in terms of, did you get any credit during the IDR waiver? If you did, then that could potentially be added to your entire consolidated loan. But if you have undergrad loans, you have a gap, then you took out grad loans, there are two different forgiveness timelines. Now, you know, in terms of the two different forgiveness timelines, you know, it depends on what happens with the SAVE plan, because that's the only one, you know, repay used to be 20 years for undergrad, 25 years for grad. You know, new IBR is 20 years for everything. Old IBR is 25 years for everything. So, you know, we just have to see what the dust settles with this lawsuit stuff. And then we got to kind of figure out what you would do based off of however the dust settles, basically. Hopefully that helps. I know it's a pretty common situation. What usually happens, though, is the undergrad debt, at least for a lot of our clients, is very tiny compared to the grad debt in a lot of cases. And so then you really get a situation where the grad debt is dominating the strategy and the undergrad debt is just sort of along for the ride because, you know, a lot of times it's not a huge amount. It's $20,000 to $30,000 compared to maybe 5 to 20 times that amount, potentially. If you did a dental specialty residency, it'd be probably 20 times the undergrad amount. So that's just kind of why we don't go into that case, because the undergrad debt doesn't drive the strategy. The grad debt does. Now, another question.
Hi, my name is Jane. I'm a longtime listener and I guess second time calling up. I had two questions that came up during the transition from the old Mohila platform to the new Mohila platform. I just got off the phone after being on the phone with Mohila for an hour and a half before I eventually got hung up on by my representative who had placed me on hold many times. So I thought I would come here next. When the transition happened, I received a notice that my interest had been capitalized, which I thought seemed wrong because I didn't ask to be transitioned to between platforms. To be clear, I am not on the SAVE plan. I'm not a public service loan forgiveness person. I'm on the pay as you earn plan. So I received a notice that my interest had been capitalized. So that was obviously very concerning. I thought this must be a mistake. I used the secure messaging platform and they said my inquiry was too complex for them to answer. I should call. So I waited to see, maybe it was a mistake and it will be addressed. I got my August notice of my statement and it said that my interest had been capitalized, that my new balance was $25,000 more than it had previously been of my principal. So I finally called
And I was told that it was not because of the forbearance, placed on hold for a very long time until I was given an explanation related to something called a monitor run. And so my question for you is, what is a monitor run? Are student loan servicers allowed to look at how our repayment has been going? Which, to be clear, I've never missed a payment. I've been on auto pay the whole time, and I've made many extra payments toward my loan. The only time I didn't make payments was during the COVID forbearance. I asked many questions about what a monitor run was. I could not find anything about it on the internet. So she said maybe it's an internal term. So I'm hoping that this is something that one of you has heard before that you could address on the podcast. My second question was about auto pay on the new Mohila platform. My instructions were not translated properly for auto pay when it transitioned. So I had been paying an extra $300 a month on top of my pay as you earn amount, since it was based off my 2018 income and I can afford a bit more now. So when that was transferred over, it was transferred over incorrectly. So the $500 total was spread out among all the loans. So as a result, I could not figure out how to change it. I tried many things until finally I canceled my auto pay and then I reset it up, which I still couldn't figure out how to set it up. So I just set it for the minimum payment for now so I could direct my additional payments to the highest interest loan. So my question is there any way to properly do this? I tried to do it over the messaging. It wouldn't let me when I was on the phone with them earlier. She said she couldn't do anything because since I had canceled it, it didn't show as being set up again yet, even though it shows on my end. And as a result, because I pressed cancel, apparently now for a month or two, however long it takes for them to get the auto pay properly set back up, I will not get my 0.25 interest rate reduction, which is a big bummer. I guess a little bummer. It's not that much, but anyways, I hope that you could help with those two questions. One about what the heck is a monitor run and am I being bamboozled with this interest rate capitalization? And number two, how can I get my auto pay instructions to be followed by Mohila? Thank you so much.
Yeah, this totally sounds like something they just like made up for the lulz. I mean, like I'm like, what? What are they even talking about? I mean, maybe they saw some sort of like forbearance or something that they should have capitalized the interest and they didn't, and then they should have. But you know, that just sounds really bizarre. So I think that I would probably file an FSA complaint. That's what I typically tell people, right? I would just go to the FSA complaint, just Google search. That's what I would do, and then go to the website. And then just file the complaint. And that's a lot more efficient than dealing with the servicer directly, because then Department of Ed jumps in and they just have a process for how they handle and resolve complaints. So that's one way I would do it. The other thing I would say is I would be a little concerned that you said you're paying extra and you're on the pay plan, just because a lot of times if you're on pay, you probably need to go for forgiveness, right? So if you're doing pay, I guess what I like to do is say, keep your all your options open for forgiveness just in case. And until you're like totally sure that you're going to go pay off your loans, I'd kind of tell people not to pay extra on their loans. Take the money, invest it, max your retirement accounts, build your emergency savings, maybe buy a house, literally do everything else but pay extra on your loans. And then when you are absolutely positive you're going to pay off your loans, you want to have good term life insurance, good disability insurance, especially if you're in a medical profession. And then from a position of strength, then you start making ginormous payments. And your first payment should probably be enormous just because you're really committing. I kind of like that approach versus paying $200 or $300 a month extra. But, you know, if you're really positive you're going to go for payoff, then it's not unreasonable to do what you're doing. But I would just follow the FSA complaint to try to get that interest uncapitalized, I guess. So, yeah. One more question basically is one I'm getting a lot from people. And just it's sort of like, what do I do? What do I do? I mean, do I need to be worried? Can I still get forgiveness? To me, this is kind of like a situation where there's a big lawsuit and we just don't know what the resolution is going to be. And it's kind of like, you know, one of those situations where the estate tax limit is 10 million exemption and it's set to go down to 1 million and you're, you know, somebody with a small business that's worth $5 million and you're old and you're about to pass away and you're like, oh, I don't want to have my entire business valuation taxed at 40% so I can pass it on to my kids, you know, tax it, legal advisor, what should I do? Should I panic? And the reality is usually Congress does the right thing, but at the very last second, only when they're forced to. So this is a situation where the courts are just like really stepping in aggressively. I mean, you could really say that the executive branch stepped in pretty aggressively as well, right? I mean, so everybody's stepping in aggressively with their preferred policy outcomes, and it's just going to be settled by the courts. And then from a point of political pressure, Congress might intervene and jump in. And so what I think will happen is if it's just an imposition of the pre-COVID rules, which I think, again, is the most likely scenario, that is not a disaster. It is not good. I want to be clear, it's not good, but it's not a disaster, because if it was just pre-COVID rules, pay, repay, IBR, those are things we can navigate around. A lot more people are eligible for new IBR nowadays than they were back in the day when I first started doing this by a long shot. So, you know, we can still get people a lot of benefits, a lot of relief if it's pre-COVID rules. If it's only IBR and that is it, we will have to get a lot more creative. We will be have to be a lot more careful with like things like, what is your AGI? What is your payment cap? We're going to have to get a PhD level review of payment cap calculations to make sure people will be below caps and such if they're going for loan forgiveness or PSLF or something like that. So, but we're not there yet, so we just have to keep waiting. And I appreciate you listening through a pretty long episode today. This is a little bit longer one, but I thought all of the questions were so good, and I just really wanted to get to as many as I possibly could. If you want to ask a question that we'll feature on the podcast, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Again, that's studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. And if you have the question, I guarantee a lot of other people have the question too. And we clearly have a lot of listeners who have just a lot on their minds and a lot of concerns right now. So I'm really grateful everybody spent time to call in. And if you need a backup plan for save repeal, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/book. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Student Loan Planner podcast. Have a wonderful week.